Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 37. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, Paul Polton and I are going to be looking at a couple of steampunky kind of movies. The first one is from 1965, and we're stretching a definition by calling it steampunk, and it is A Great Race with Tony Curtis, Natalie Wood, and Jack Lemmon. And the second one is a French film, which is definitely steampunky, and that is 2010's The Extraordinary Adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec, starring Louise Bourgoin, and it is a lot of fun. That one I'm really looking forward to talking with Paul about. The Great Race, we'll find out why Paul likes it. I wasn't that keen on it. Now sit back and I'll get the contact details out of the way. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from Georges Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Okay, here I am with Paul Polton, and we're talking steampunky kind of movies, one from the 2010, and one from 1965, being in reverse order, The Great Race and The Extraordinary Adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec. How are you, Paul?
Good, good. Thank you for having me back.
No, that's okay. I dragged you across Melbourne on the long weekend when we went to the convention for a restaurant that wasn't open, so it's only fair that I have you back on the show.
It's good to get out.
Yeah, we got a bit of aerobic exercise. Yeah. But the barbecue place wasn't open, which really sucks a lot.
Yeah, which, you know, you'd sort of expect on a public holiday that they would hope to get more people in, but
so obviously we caught up a couple of weeks ago, which wasn't too long ago, at the convention. Had a good time there. Always good to catch up with people. I started the Patreon thing for the podcast as well, as you might have seen on Facebook.
Yes.
Where people can subscribe to the podcast for as little as $1 a month. You don't get much extra for it, but if you want to support the podcast and support the hosting for it, go to Patreon, patreon.com/paleocinema, and become a supporter of Paleo Cinema Podcast and the Martian Drive-In Podcast in a financial but not too arduous way. And that's going actually well. We've got a number of people on there. Some people have done one-off donations of two-figure sums.
Okay.
And I've got the first year's hosting for one of the podcasts covered, so I'm very happy about that.
You'll have to start getting, you know, tea towels and fridge magnets and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I did the fridge magnets. I mean, I've been handing out fridge magnets at conventions for a couple of years now. I didn't actually buy them. They're a birthday present from somebody.
So you get
grabbed my logo and then just did a whole bunch of merch for me.
Have a Paleo Cinema coffee mug or something, you know.
Well, yeah, but what did we do? Baseball caps. I gave Sal the baseball cap.
All right, yeah.
If I wear a baseball cap, I look like I'm having chemotherapy. So I don't do that. I've got a bag. I've got a Paleo Cinema bag here.
Right, yeah.
No Martian Drive-In podcast merch yet, so I'm going to have to look into that and do some merch for Martian Drive-In podcast. Mm-hmm. But, so things have been going okay here. You back at uni again?
Semester break at the moment, so...
Cool.
I moved house a few months back, so I'm getting into the tail end of all the stuff that you get to, and you go, yeah, I really should sort through that and do something with it. I'll put that off for
the... But not today.
Yeah. So,
yeah, not now.
So now I'm getting to the point of, you know, I've reached that stage and going, right, okay, so this is the box of stuff for eBay, and this is the stuff that's probably got to go to charity, and this is, I have no idea what to do with.
Oh, don't worry about it too much. I've been living here 13 years and I've still got things to do. So, yeah, it. I hate moving. I'm so glad I don't
have to. Yeah.
And I do hope you get to the stage where you don't have to again.
Well, probably one more at least, but because this is only a temporary move at the moment. But yeah, hopefully the next one will be something more permanent.
That'd be good.
Mm.
Okay, sorry, I'm eating a biscuit at the moment. I really shouldn't do that. What have you been watching?
Got to bring enough to share with everyone.
I did. It's me, myself, and I've got three biscuits.
There you go. Bit of a variety of things, some old, some new. I finally got round to seeing the RoboCop remake.
And, me too, I've seen it.
And despite sort of my trepidation going in, it wasn't fantastic, but it wasn't a complete disaster as I had been expecting it to be.
I think people had low expectations. Yeah, people have very low expectations on that.
You sort of go, oh, Jesus, not another remake.
It doesn't have the satirical edge.
It's certainly a lot drier with that one. Last week I watched Monuments Men.
I've seen that.
Which I thought was a very interesting historical story, which you know, I had vague knowledge of that. Yes, there were these guys who were trying to track down the stolen artworks, but I didn't realise that they were actually doing it during the war. But I think as a piece of drama or entertainment, it did lack a lot.
I think the main problem with it was budgetary. They were doing it on a fairly small shoestring and doing a period movie. Even if you got big stars who were taking a pay cut to do it, I think that, you know, you've got limitations there. But it's nice seeing people like Jean Dujardin doing an English language film.
And I think it's, you know, it's another one of Clooney's pet projects that, you know, he'll go off and do the blockbusters for the paycheck so that he can afford to do, you know, these other sort of little bits and pieces that interest him. And, you know, yeah, maybe it could have... It may have come across better as a sort of a documentary or something, but I thought it didn't have any sort of sense or it could have been done better on a bigger scale. But yeah, as you say, you know, budgetary restraints.
It felt to me a little bit like one of those movies that they did in the 1950s in England, you know, a black and white English film done by Ealing or something like that. It's got a bit of that to it.
And speaking of remakes, the other one that I dug out, I got onto a bit of a Nazi theme. I dug up an old copy of Hindenburg with George C. Scott because I'd heard that there was a TV remake done a few years back, and I managed to track that down, and oh my god.
Bad.
So bad. It crashed and burned like the Hindenburg.
Yep. Well, George C. Scott's one of my least favourite actors.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, the original was compelling movie viewing compared to the remake.
Yeah.
So.
But, George C. Scott tended to... Yeah, talk to women with his fists.
Yeah, yeah.
So, fuck George C. Scott. I don't care.
Yeah.
anything else that good you've been watching?
Other than that, we sort of get on to, the TV. A lot of shows wrapped up earlier this year. Yep. You know, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. wrapped up. Game of Thrones wrapped up for this year. I'm quite happy to hear that Murdoch Mysteries has been renewed for another season. That's one of my my little fanboy things. Cool. And I got round to watching. I've watched the first episode of Penny Dreadful, which looks promising.
I don't mind a bit of Penny Dreadful.
Yeah, I know it's been renewed for a second season, but yeah, I never got round to actually watching it. So
the big complaint a lot of people have with Penny Dreadful is that it's the plot's slow to develop. They're establishing characters and establishing relationships and showing little bits of plot. But because people in the 21st century want immediate gratification, it's not catering to that.
Yeah.
And,
although I think, as I saw somebody having a rant recently talking about TV shows that start off with previously on such and such, and they'll give you like a 5-minute recap, and it's like, I know what happened. I've been binge watching the first series for the last 24 hours. I don't need to be reminded every friggin' episode.
Yeah, I think that's a legacy from soap operas of the 1950s and 1960s, where if you didn't watch them right at the time, you just didn't see them.
Yeah. And I think today, you know, so many people are either, you know, either buying box sets or they're buying it off, you know, Amazon or iTunes or whatever, and people actually sitting down watching or talking to Uncle Torrance, that people actually sitting down to watch something at, you know, 7:30 or 8:30 when it's aired on TV, is a far lesser number of people than ever.
Absolutely, yeah. But yeah, so anything else good?
That's been pretty much my things at the moment for visual stuff. Yeah.
Let me see what I've been watching, because I've been watching a lot of genre stuff since last I spoke into this microphone. Let me see. I'm sticking to the genre stuff again. I did watch Reptilicus, which is that, I think Swedish or Danish or something, giant dinosaur movie from the early 1960s.
Oh, yeah, vaguely remember that.
Yeah, that one's kind of interesting because it's so haphazard.
Yeah.
And done on a limited budget and done in a totally strange place for these sorts of
things. Yeah, I think I had a mate of mine who was a big Godzilla fan, and I think I remember watching that on a video donkeys ago.
Yeah.
And we're sort of going, what the hell is this? So.
Yeah, so I watched that. I did the radio gig, and I threw Liz a bit of a sideways curve, and we did My Neighbor Totoro.
All right, yeah.
Which worked really well. She's going to show it to her kids, and just blew her away, and Miyazaki and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We had a bit of a chat around his career and things like that, which was a lot of fun, and it was nice throwing her something that she can then take and show to the kids rather than the usual things we do.
Yes. Yeah, well, I suppose that's a case of, you know, I mean, you know, the current buzz at the moment, everybody's on the Game of Thrones bandwagon, whether you've either read the books and are watching the visual, or you've never read the books and are going, oh, my God, this is great. And, you know, I know my brother's got three kids, and none of them are allowed to watch it, and yet my, I suppose, what do I call him, my stepbrother, sort of, anyway, he's also got three kids who are younger, but he's let his eldest watch that. You know, it's interesting hearing the grandparents' opinions on, you know, what's appropriate.
Yeah, but Totoro was just, I hadn't seen it for a few years, and it sucked me way back in again, which I really loved, and I'm going to have to revisit some of my Miyazaki.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw that this thing called The Host with Saoirse Ronan in it. About alien invasion, all that.
I've got that sitting here to watch, but I've had a few people sort of say, you know, yeah.
It's let me see. How would I say this? Piss poor and ordinary. So I do like Saoirse Ronan as an actress, but nah, it really did nothing for me. It added nothing at all to my life in any way at all.
Because I watched
stealing a couple of hours.
I watched. City of Bones, which is a similar sort of, I suppose, you know, teen supernatural genre type thing. And that was okay, but a lot of people sort of said, yeah, look, if you weren't impressed with City of Bones, The Host is not even going to make it that far. And I went, okay. But, you know, I don't know. I'll get there one day.
Yep. And I bought myself a Chromecast, which is one of those HDMI dongles, which hooks into your Wi-Fi and lets you stream YouTube and a few other websites to your TV directly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was about $49. I went down to JB Hi-Fi and picked one up. And so I've been watching movies that are on full movie on eBay. Oh, sorry, on YouTube.
You can hook up those, you know, 10-hour YouTube clips of the Badger song or...
Anything I want, I can just stream it live. And so I've been having a little bit of fun with that and watching a few things. So I rewatched John Carpenter's Ghosts of Mars, which is basically a West set on Mars in a matriarchal society. And you could kind of see what he was shooting for. It was a very early role for Jason Statham. And Natasha Henstridge is in it. Pam Grier is in it. And a few other people. But basically, it's a Western. So that was a bit ordinary. I saw a movie called Stakeland from about 2010, I think it is.
I don't know that one.
Which is a kind of post-zombie apocalypse thing.
Right.
Fairly low budget, filmed around Pennsylvania, but you know, it wasn't too bad at all. And then I watched two more movies on YouTube. One of them was on Crackle.com. And that was called, it's got two names, this movie. It's called Ah Zombies. And it's also called Wasting Away. It's a very low budget film about, a group of 20-somethings, four of them, who become zombies and don't know that they're zombies.
Oh, okay.
They're wondering why everybody else is acting really fucking weird and things like that. And so, you know, it's one night in Los Angeles and there's a zombie uprising. They're the zombies. They think everybody else is acting weird. And, it's a nice little cute, almost whimsical movie. A whimsical zombie movie is something you really should look towards. And it's from about 2007 and I didn't mind it at all. And the other thing I watched from 1989 was Robot Jocks.
Oh, God.
With Gary Graham and the stop-motion giant mecha having a fight kind of things. And that wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. I wasn't really disappointed. For its time, it had some reasonable special effects. This is pre-computer graphics, of course. And, yeah, it wasn't entirely a waste of time. It was just a little bit of fun, one of those diverting little things that you haven't got anything to do, you just sit down and put something on, and it wasn't disappointing. So that's about it for what I've been watching. So we should start talking about the two movies of which we are going to speak.
Alrighty.
We'll do them chronologically, of course, so we'll do the one you like first, and then we'll do the one I like. I'll let you gush about The Great Race for a bit before I say what I felt about it, because you and I disagree, but we'll disagree as gentlemen.
Yes, all right.
And that kind of thing, but before you do, I'll put in some trailer or something like that for The Great Race here.
Tony Curtis is brave, of course, but he's never been as brave as this before. Jack Lemmon. Funny? Naturally. But never so fantastically funny as this. Men chasing Natalie Wood? Not surprising, but never so frantically before. Has ever been as great as they are in the world's greatest comedy, The Great Race. It's the greatest. It's the gayest. It's the wildest. It's the funniest. And how could it help but be with Jack Lemmon as Professor Fate, the meanest villain that ever twirled a mustache? Tony Curtis as the great Leslie, gallant lover and heroic daredevil. Natalie Wood as Maggie Dubois, loveliest of lovely damsels in distress. Peter Falk, Keenan Wynn, Larry Storch, Dorothy Provine. It's the fabulous around-the-world race from New York to Paris. A rambunctious, rib-busting riot of a race. Its high points only outrun by the hilarity of what happens in between heats.
You are an emancipated woman, Mr. Bond. And I am an emancipated man.
They'll lead you a merry chase on land, under the sea, and in the air. You'll never stop laughing once you've started The Great Race.
Hmm. Okay, that was some audio from The Great Race. Now, it's a 1965 movie, and it stars Jack Lemmon as Professor Fate and Crown Prince Frederick Hoepnik.
Tony Curtis, Natalie Wood, Peter Falk, Keenan Wynn, Arthur O'Connell, Vivian Vance, Dorothy Provine, Larry Storch, Ross Martin, George McCready, and Marvin Kaplan.
I'll repeat that a little bit more slowly. Tony Curtis, Natalie Wood, Peter Falk, Keenan Wynn, Arthur O'Connell, Vivian Vance, Dorothy Provine, Larry Storch, Ross Martin, George McCready, and Marvin Kaplan. And this is one of your favourite movies, Paul, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know whether I'd say it was a guilty pleasure, because I have absolutely no guilt of it whatsoever. I love this movie. It's one I've watched multiple times, and it's so, I suppose a lot of it is just so outrageous that you can't help but laugh.
Mm. It's a bit dastardly and muttly, really. It influenced Wacky Races.
Actually, yeah, the Wacky Races cartoon was actually as a sort of a later direct inspiration from this. So Penelope Pitstop is of course Natalie Wood's character, Maggie Dubois. Dick Dastardly is Professor Fate, and Peter Perfect is the Great Leslie, and Muttley of course is sort of a vague reference to, you know, Professor Fate having this, you know, the sniveling sidekick,
Max.
So yeah, it's all tied into that. But even that, the movie itself is based on, there was a real race from New York to Paris, in 1908, 1907. And, I mean, this race obviously bears very little resemblance to the actual race. You know, the fact that there was a competition of sorts, and they, you know, they raced overland, and it was sponsored by a newspaper. There were two newspapers who were sponsoring it, so it got quite a lot of press coverage. But at the time, I suppose it
was a media event.
And it also, I suppose, it changed the public's perception of what these, you know, at the time, these horseless carriages were capable of, because I remember somebody pointing out years ago, they said the roads across Europe in 1888 were better than they were in 1908, because after the advent of the railroad, everything went by rail. So, you know, trying to do sort of intercontinental road trips, you know, people said, no, just put on the train, you know. The actual road conditions were a lot worse in the sort of early 1900s than they had been, you know, 20, 30 years before that.
Yeah, and there was also, I mean, they're still doing road rallies. There's the Shipbox Rally up in the Northern Territory.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Which goes from Adelaide to Darwin.
And the old the Cannonball Run. Which also got itself a movie. So.
And the Red X Trials. Mm-hmm. Which appeared in Newsfront, the Australian film. They did a little bit about the newsreel cameraman filming that as well. And but I like the Shipbox Rally because it gets people on the radio saying Shipbox. And the Shipbox Rally does really well. It makes a lot of money for charity. And then when all the cars get to Darwin, they sell them.
Yeah. Well, if they get to a point where, if they get to a point where they can't repair a car, they won't just dump it on the side of the road either. You know, it'll usually get cannibalized for parts for other entries. So, you know, they're not.
And also they take the wreck away as well. They've got a whole bunch of tow trucks and things like that for it. So, yeah. But, yeah, that part of it was interesting. Blake Edwards directed it. This is coming off of some great successes for Blake Edwards. Let me see what he did just before this, because I know he did The Party with Peter Sellers around this time. Mm-hmm. His real last name was Crump, C-R-U-M-P.
Yeah, well, I can see why he changed that for Hollywood.
Yep. Yeah, The Party was actually after this, 1968.
Okay.
Before that, he did the, let's see what he did just before this, A Shot in the Dark and The Pink Panther. So they're the two that really got him.
Yeah, I mean, this certainly the the camp comedy of the Pink Panther comes through in this.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is I suppose it's really sort of three vignette set pieces. You've got sort of the whole opening thing setting up the characters. You know, you've got Professor Fate and the Great Leslie, who are two I suppose, you know, they're escapologists or entertainers of, you know,
yep,
death-defying stuff, all of that. And they're doing various back-and-forth things. And, I mean, some of the inventions that Professor Fate comes out with, you know, he's got his balloon bicycle, he's got the little mini submarine. And
the cannon in the front of the car.
Yeah, the cannon and all these things. It's like, you know, the guy is obviously genius level. He's just, you know, obviously plagued by bad luck.
Well, he's not big on health and safety.
Well, no. And the Great Leslie is, you know, everything is white. The boots are white. The shirt is white. The hats are white. The car is white. The teeth glint white. And then you've
I found him very insufferable for that.
Yeah, well, I think that was generally the idea. And you know, you've got Natalie Wood playing Maggie Dubois, the sort of the suffragette's suffragette. And then, you know, you've got sort of, I suppose, the set pieces of we arrive in Baracho, which is the excuse to have all of the Western movie cliches. You've got, you know, the showgirl, the barroom brawl. You've got the you know, Texas Jack, you know, sort of the gunslinger. You've got
you're shorter than everyone else.
Yeah. You've got the Indian chase. So you've got, you know, there's a whole bunch of cliches there. Then we get to Europe and it's, you know, it's a riff stolen directly out of A Prisoner of Zenda.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Crown Prince Humpnick being identical in appearance to Professor Fate. So they try and switch them to, you know, have a coup in the country. Potsdorf, I think was the. Potsdorf was the city. Carpania was the country. And then, you know, you sort of, they finish that and they get back to, they get out of that and it's sort of the final leg into Paris and all that. But yeah, it's sort of really three set pieces. And I mean, even partway towards the end, partway you've got, you know, we're having a break. So we have the sing along with the follow the bouncing ball thing. And it's just, you know,
a lot of it, and the other influence on the movie too is silent movies.
Yeah.
Silent movie comedies.
Well,
you've
I mean,
got all the tropes from those.
Yeah, you just look at Jack Lemmon's makeup with, you know, he's got the twisty mustache, he's got the dark eyeliner with the, I mean, those eyebrows are painted on. And, you know, the black and the top hats and the whole bit.
Yeah, he looks very much like one of the villains in an early Chaplin movie. So, yeah, and there were some things about this movie that impressed me. The stunt work is pretty damn good.
Yes.
There's some fantastic stunts in it. I like Dorothy Provine doing her song and dancing in Baracho, playing Lily Olay.
Yes.
That was kind of cool because Dorothy Provine was very cute and a good singer and a dancer, and she lifted the movie for me in that part, so it was dragging a little bit before that for me.
Yeah.
So, those bits I liked. I liked a lot of the second unit work was pretty good, and all the stuff they made for Professor Fate, all of the gadgets and things, were nicely put together as well.
One thing I was actually, because you know, I watched it again just before doing this, and I was reading through some of the notes, and I don't know how many times I've watched this movie, and I had never picked this up before. There were two things. One, I had noticed before, and the other one, I'm going, I've never noticed it before. So, you know, rewind, it's like, holy shit, there it is. Mm-hmm. Right at the start, when they're inside Professor Fate's mansion, there's a moose head up on the wall.
Mm.
And, you know, you go, oh, it's a moose head. And then there's one scene where they think they're being, somebody's trying to sneak in to steal the secrets of the car. So they run towards the garage door, and as they go past, the back of the moose is sticking out from the wall. And I had never noticed that before. I was sitting there going, what? How did I not notice that? And the other one that I had picked up, but again, sort of had the same reaction when I first saw it, During the ballroom scene in Potsdorf, there's, yep. there's a close-up. The camera's focused on Leslie with whoever he's dancing with at that point. Yep. And Jack Lemmon, as Prince Hupnik, dances behind him with another man. They're yep. waltzing behind him. And you're sort of going, what? Hang on, did I just see that? And you go back.
Well, Prince Hupnik is kind of very camp.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot. This is one of the movies from the mid-60s that pisses me off. And I'll tell you why. And it's not just this film. It's a whole genre of films. And it's a whole bunch of studio films. There are all these. I mean, ostensibly, this is a movie for kids as much as anybody else, right?
Yeah.
And yet, it's 2.5 hours and it has an intermission in the middle. Kids don't sit still for that long. It's like the 1967 Dr. Doolittle, which went on forever. It was supposed to be a kid's movie. And the kids were going out, Mum, I want to go take a piss. Or Mum, I want some ice cream or something like that.
Well, that's why you had an interval.
Yeah, I know that. But kids wouldn't sit there through the whole movie. And a lot of these movies, this one cost $12 million, which was a big film in those days. Mm. And they all died in the arse and didn't make the money back, including this one. Yeah, it's just, it felt bloated and it wasn't very funny for me. I mean, you and I got different senses of humour. We're friends, but we've got different senses of humour.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just didn't work for me that well.
Ah, well.
Yeah, but that's fine. I mean, it is. It does have that steampunk, precedes steampunk and influences a lot. It's influenced a lot of things afterwards. So in that sense, it's a successful movie. And long term, it's probably made a lot of money.
Yeah.
Didn't work.
I was going to say, I'd be curious to see what, you know, because I do see it turn up. It's had a DVD release. I think the first time I went looking for it, I had to get it on an NTSC video, because it wasn't available in Australia. But, you know, I think it's had a Blu-ray release since. They probably need to do a re-clean. But, you know, it's like so many of these movies, you know, Rocky Horror Picture Show that died in the ass when it was first released, but over the years with DVD releases and all that sort of stuff has slowly but surely, you know, amassed a small fortune.
Yeah. And did make its money back. It made twice its money back, which is not too bad for the time. But it's one of those movies that most people don't remember. There are a lot of movies from the middle of the 60s that people remember, but this one I think may have kind of, you know, dodged people's attention for some reason.
Yeah, I think probably, you know, when people are doing 60s nostalgia, the whole spy genre is the one that first comes to mind. Mm. And because there are so many, even today, I think you'd be hard pressed to find a similar sort of movie to this style. But so, you know, whereas the spy genre, you've got everything from both sides of the Atlantic, you know, between Bond and
yeah. Well, this came out same year as Thunderball. Yeah. And one of the things, and this is something you notice from other films as well, Blake Edwards was born in, let me see, and this is pertinent. I'm just funny. He was born in 1922, so he spent his childhood watching silent films.
Mm.
So he's intensely nostalgic for that kind of stuff. But a lot of people who were going to the cinemas in the 60s were born after him. And so while he's incredibly nostalgic for this, there's a couple of generations after him.
Yep.
That really, you know, don't have the same reference points to those films as he does.
Yeah.
And you get that nowadays. It's like people making kind of movies that have disco themes and things like that these days. There's a couple of generations.
Yes.
That didn't grow up with that and don't get the references and don't have that the same nostalgia. Yeah. And I think that this may be one of the things that's made this movie date a little more than some other films is because it's nostalgic for something that happened. It's still within human memory, but very fading and vague memory at this stage.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to spoil your enjoyment of it.
No. Look, I'm quite happy for people to say, look, you know, it didn't do it for me. But, you know, what you're saying, yeah, I mean, that could be sort of part of the reason that I enjoy it because there are so many, you know, like the whole allusion to Prisoner of Zenda. There are probably I would say there are probably far less people who would be aware of that that was even a book, much less that that plot was a pastiche, who, you know, even when the movie was released, and probably far less now, because, you know, those sort of the old books, you know, people might, they might know the title, but, you know, so very few people have read them.
Yeah. And you might have seen previous versions of Prisoner of Zenda too. There was the Ronald Coleman one and all that kind of stuff as well. And I think they did it in Get Smart and every other comedy from the 1960s.
Yeah, well, you know, that was, I mean, certainly with television, there was an ongoing thing there for a while with, well, not so much necessarily the evil twin, but the, I think, you know, Bewitched had the more outgoing or mischievous brunette sister, and I think Jeannie.
No, that was a cousin, yeah.
Cousin, and yeah.
I would have nailed that cousin.
Yeah, Jeannie did it as well, I'm pretty sure.
Again, another one that was sexier than the main character.
Yeah, and you know, that there were quite a few of those going through, you know, they'd turn up in a variety of TV shows. So that that whole sort of, you know, evil double or less moral double was a bit of a thing then.
Well, the reverse on this one is that the fact that the person who takes over the role of the prince consort, or yeah, the royal prince, is the evil one.
Well, yes, yeah.
Instead of being the naive thing, Professor Fate is the evil one, and the actual prince is very flamboyant and very over the top and very camp.
So, and, but even even things like seeing, I suppose, you know, Ross Martin, who up until then was predominantly playing the good guys, and yeah, he was a leading man actor, and in this one he gets a chance to play the villain.
Yeah, he was in the Wild Wild West as well, playing Artemus Gordon.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you got him in there. I think that there are scenes in this movie that I liked for one silly reason. Peter Falk steals scenes very well in this.
Yeah.
And he's a lot of fun playing Max. I mean, his double takes are really good.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff he does and facial expressions and things like that. And, yeah, Peter Falk, consummate steal of scenes in the movie. And I kind of kept watching it for him more than anything. The second movie Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis did too, they did Some Like It Hot in 59 with Billy Wilder.
Yep.
Again with some very camp characters in it, but apparently Natalie Wood didn't enjoy making this film.
Yes, yeah, so the story goes.
Something like sexual harassment from Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon.
Well, I mean, she did spend the last half of the movie getting around in stockings and a corset. And then sort of even part of that was covered with cream for.
But women should be allowed to dress how they like.
Oh, no, I realise that. I realise that. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
But actually, that pie fight scene, they had to do, something like about, you know, 10 resets because, I mean, everybody got told not to aim at Tony Curtis because that was sort of the ongoing gag that everybody else was getting hit by pies and Mr. White wasn't getting anything splashed on him, but occasionally he'd get sort of a ricochet that would land on his outfit and they'd have to go, right, okay, cut, go get changed, put on a new jumper or new pants or something. Apparently all of the pies were, you know, they weren't like fake cream or anything. That was all real pie.
So, yeah. Well, you know, you got to do that. Can you imagine the ants on the set afterwards? That would have been chronic. There would have been cats coming around licking the cream. There would have been ants everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, you would have had to, like, disinfect the place.
I was going to say, you wouldn't have to clean up. You just, you know, you bring in the local dog squad and let them go.
Yeah, well, if it was me, what I'd do is you film it all inside a giant swimming pool. And then you just fill the fucker up and then the filters take care of it.
Hose it out.
Yeah. Only way to do it. But, did you notice the anachronism with the Eiffel Tower?
Well, other than it falling down.
Yeah, well, other than it falling down, it's got a TV antenna on the top of it.
Oh, no, I missed that.
Yeah, because the original Eiffel Tower didn't have that little spire right at the top. That's
okay.
The telecommunications tower. I know, big up there.
Because I know they replaced the first floor, first level. Mm. It used to have these sort of arches all around it, and then they pulled those off and put up basically a fence, I think, to stop people jumping off.
Yeah, you don't really want to do that.
No. So
when I went there in 2004, and the first level, you've got that big base part with the arch on it.
Mm.
At the top of that level is the restaurant Jules Verne.
All right, yes.
It's all done in kind of Belle Epoque, Jules Verne kind of architecture.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so, you know, they're very big on their literary history there.
Yes.
But it was nice seeing the streets of Paris.
Well, I believe all around the edges of that level, it's very hard to see from the ground, but, you know, if you look up, they had all of the French literary greats' names. They're all sort of done in brass or something like that around the edge of the tower. So, but yeah, it's one of those things, unless you know that it's there to look for it, it's quite easily slips under your radar.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, Melbourne takes three goes just to put up a Ferris wheel. And that thing's been there since 1888.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of credit to the French.
And, I mean, that was only put up as – it was only supposed to be a temporary thing because that was put up
– Yeah, it's for the exhibition.
Yeah, so
But, no, any movie with the Eiffel Tower in it is improved by the fact that it's got the Eiffel Tower in it.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So anything else you want to say about The Great Race to try to get people to watch it?
It's one of those ones. It doesn't take itself seriously in any way. I mean, all of the characters are cliches. The plot line is full of cliches, and it's one of those, sit down and switch off and just, you know, enjoy a bit of a film.
Yeah, and it came out at the same time as those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines as well.
I think that was – that came out the year after because of
– No, they're both 1965.
Are they? Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so there was a lot of nostalgia for that kind of stuff there. And that's got a good cast in it as well. Stuart Whitman, Sarah Miles, James Fox, Robert Morley, Gert Frober, Terry Thomas, Jean-Pierre Cassel, Eric Sykes is in it, Red Skelton, Benny Hill.
Yes.
I'm going to have to watch that again now. I think I might enjoy that one a lot more. It's got Benny Hill in it with no yakety sax, but I think I might enjoy that one a bit more than this one. But yeah, I think it was a bit long for me. Yeah, I kind of like comedies where characters engage me a bit more than these guys did. They were all playing a little too cardboard in a sense. And then there was all that suffragette stuff, which was just there basically to make guys feel good about themselves too. So watching it in the 21st century, it does suffer for that as well.
Well, yes. Yeah. It's still very 60s in its look at women's rights and suffragism.
Yeah. Basically it was almost a kind of gag line throughout the movie. The fact that women should be the equal of men and guys were all going, hoo, hoo, hoo. And then the woman would do some comeuppance, but she'd then have a fall and or do a pratfall or some way make it okay for the guys again.
Yeah.
Which is one of the problems with a lot of those comedies at the time. They weren't really nice to women in some ways.
Mm.
But anyway, we'll move on from that and we'll look at something that does have a slightly more feminist slant after we take a break. And it is the 2010 film directed by Luc Besson, The Extraordinary Adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec.
This is the story of Adèle Blanc-Sec and her quest for the power of life over death. Her journey would take her to distant lands, to face many dangers beneath the sands. But when something evil stirs in its sleep, a mysterious monster is unleashed on the streets. With time running out and a city in fear, Adèle must risk everything that she holds dear. She's in a battle only one can win. Her great greatest adventure is about to begin. Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec.
Okay, and we're back, and that was the trailer to The Extraordinary Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec, a 2010 French film directed by Luc Besson, who we remember from films like The Fifth Element, The Big Blue. What else has he done? He's doing the upcoming Lucy with Scarlett Johansson. And a ton of other good quality action films that for some reason a lot of people don't like. So I should do a bit of a précis on the movie before we start talking, Paul.
All right, yep.
Okay, so it's based on a comic book series by a guy called Jacques Tardy, not to be mixed up with Jacques Tati. Basically, there are a whole bunch of different stories about Adele Blanc-Sec, a woman in and around the early part of the 20th century in Paris, incorporates real-life locations and events into kind of fantastical adventures. And, and this one stars Louise Bourgoin. Basically, Adele Blanc-Sec is looking to use ancient Egyptian technology because her sister had an unfortunate tennis accident and has a hat pin sticking through her brain. And Adele thinks that if she can resurrect some Egyptian mummies, she can get the ancient Egyptian medicine to help her with her sister. Unfortunately, the guy that she wants to get to help her with resurrect the mummies has accidentally resurrected a pterodactyl as well, and that becomes a little bit of a complication.
As you do,
yeah, because there's nothing better than casting a spell and resurrecting a pterodactyl in Belle Epoque, Paris.
Mm.
And this one's a lot of fun. What do you reckon?
Yeah, it's certainly, there's a whole fantastical side of it, from the pterodactyls to talking mummies to, some of the Egyptology stuff, I'm just sitting there going, it's this whole very whimsical, the character of Adele Blanc-Sec is a very forthright, up front, no nonsense, this is what I'm going to do. Right, fine, okay, we'll do that.
And she's very cynical and sardonic as well.
Yes, yeah. And again, there's lots of stereotypes that you've got in this. We've got the incompetent police inspector. We've got local politician who's, supposedly a bastion of, morality, who's found with a showgirl, the demi-modernes of Adele Blanc-Sec, all that sort of stuff.
Yep. Yeah, and there's just so many nice little bits to this movie. The fact that they use real Paris locations and then CGI'd the hell out of them to make them look the way they did in 1910. I mean, it's easy to do because above street level, everything still looks that way.
Mostly,
because they haven't ripped down the old buildings, and they've got all places like the Louvre. They walk past the Louvre, and it doesn't have the pyramid. And there's that joke when the resurrected pharaoh comes back and says that they should put a pyramid there.
It's a lovely courtyard. They should put a pyramid in it.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful one as well. And the fact that when the politician is at the Moulin Rouge, watching the Can-Can Girls, somebody holds up a scarf like a football fan from the 21st century with Limousine written on it. There's all these kind of weird little bits and pieces that are anachronistic and a lot of fun. Eventually Adele does have to deal with the pterodactyl and uses her feather boa to do so and starts kind of luring it with her feather boa and singing a song, which is based on a Zizi Jean-Mer act from the 1960s, Mon Truc en Plume.
Oh, so right. Yes.
Mon truc en plume, plume des oiseaux, des animaux.
So basically, it's a reference to a 1960s cabaret dance thing, anachronistically, in 1910. I kind of like that as well, the fact that a lot of people would understand that in France, but it doesn't matter if you don't get it in, if you're an Anglophone. And it's just a lovely film, and Louise Bourgoin's great in it. She's feisty and doesn't take shit from men and doesn't take shit from anybody. No. And she's determined to get this done and determined to follow the plan to get her sister some ancient medical help. And does all sorts of things, like she makes seven attempts almost. I think it's seven attempts.
Trying to get him out of prison.
Trying to get him out of prison just before he gets guillotined by going into prison in six or seven different disguises, and just keeps persisting with it. And every time they just throw her out of the prison, they don't arrest her. They just throw her back out of the front door of the prison.
No, they're just, oh, God, you again. Go away. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a lot of fun too, and watching it. And a bit of it was a little bit of a reference to Jean Moreau in Truffaut's The Bride Wore Black, because there's a scene where she's disguised as somebody delivering slops in a prison.
Oh, okay.
Right at the end of the film. So there's a kind of reference to that in there as well, which I kind of liked. And I like the fact that a lot of the actors are wearing heavy makeup, so they look like the characters did in the comic, which has got a certain exaggeration about things, but it's great fun.
The male characters are certainly, there's a penchant for the uglier the better.
Mm. And a lot of them didn't really look like that. A lot of them were just made up to be like that.
Yeah. There's a lot of prosthetics going on in this film. So,
I mean, Gulliver, the main bad guy at the start of the film, is Matthew Almerick, who played the villain in Quantum of Solace. And he's unrecognizable under the makeup, with really bad teeth and bushy eyebrows and big sticky out ears and all sorts of makeup bits and pieces like that.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where, you know, he's just having a lot of fun like everybody else is. There's Inspector Caponi, played by Gilles Lelouch, who's the copper who's trying to track down the pterodactyl, and every time he goes to eat something,
he keeps getting interrupted with his dinner. It's like, you know, just about sit down and the phone goes, or, you know.
Yeah, or he gets attacked by a pterodactyl. Or he gets shat on by a pterodactyl at the top of the Eiffel Tower.
Well, yes.
Yeah, so there's all of those nice little bits there where...
And the big game hunter bloke.
Yeah, Barbosi Justin de Saint-Hubert.
Who's still walking around Paris with the pith helmet and the safari suit.
Yep, and a monocle and all that kind of thing. And he's basically shouldn't be anywhere near a gun.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a beautiful film. And even his sister, Agatha, is a lot of fun once she does get resurrected. And neatly ties up a loose plot point for Adele as well, which is kind of cool. But the set design's fantastic. Everything's period perfect in this film, right down to Caponi's home phone is period perfect. And the anachronisms in the film are deliberate.
Yeah.
They're not accidental things of timing and things like that. I think there's one accidental one, which is the logo on a train is incorrect.
Oh, okay.
But apart from that, it's great fun. I think this film should be known by more people, because it is just such a joy, and it shows that Luc Besson doesn't just do serious stuff. I mean, of course, The Fifth Element shows him playing lighter.
Yep, yep.
But in this one, he does play really light and fun, and he's got, of course, his great skill at doing action scenes, and the action scenes in this are incredibly logical. Probably one of the best being when they find the grave of the pharaoh. It's not actually a pyramid, but it's a tomb.
Yep.
And the way things are done in that, and the way, I mean, Luc Besson is big into Egyptology.
Yeah, well, that was sort of one of the things that I'm looking at, and it's again the cliche of the secret tomb and all of the traps. And although the I think this is the first time I've ever seen anybody put in a mummy wrapping machine. It digs out all the Egyptology cliches and runs with them.
Yeah, and I think it's a lot more fun than a lot of the Indiana Jones stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, it's she's been dismissed by the guys. You know, they hold her at gunpoint once she finds the tomb and gets everything ready for them and opens up the tomb. And then she realizes what everything is and decides to take a different route to where they need to go. And, yeah, it is beautifully fun and a joyous movie. It's one of those – French do this occasionally. They do some serious and dark and grim films.
Mm.
But now and then they do something that's so life-affirming and fun. And I just love that. And not often, too. You wouldn't get this in an American film.
No.
You don't often get a nude scene by the protagonist in an American movie.
Well.
Well, no, you get occasional, like, Russell Crowe's bum or something like that. But Louise Burgoyne in the bathtub was quite a nice scene for me. And yeah, and yeah, she's great with the comedy too, and she's very gifted.
Yeah, the lighter stuff, the timing on the reactions to things is sort of it's very very well done.
Yep,
I think possibly it's certainly it is French, but it does. I think it certainly comes across that. I suppose French comedy can be an acquired taste, which is probably why it hasn't seen sort of a lot bigger
release
in the English speaking world, at least. And I mean, even with subtitles, it's sort of one of those things that some of the some of the jokes and things that play in it, you can look at and you go, what are you? Okay, yeah, right, whatever. It's one of those things that you either love that stuff or you don't.
Yeah, and one of the things I did notice, because I'm doing my French lessons and things like that. She's got a lot dirtier mouth than the subtitles would suggest. is one thing, and also she's a bit. Even the subtitles don't really get across all of the sharpness of what she's saying.
Yeah.
Which is kind of nice, and I like that too, the fact that, this is a woman that is living life on her own terms. She's a famous adventurer. She found Machu Picchu in Peru and did a lot of stuff for that, and is known as an adventurer, and yet the men still try to put her in a corner, but it never works because she just won't be put in a corner.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you don't want me to go there? Fine, I'll go this way.
Yeah, and she'll always find a way to where she wants to go. It's like parkour. She goes in a straight line between the two places she needs to be while everybody else is going off to the sides. And, it's an old-style adventure film, and I think this is a movie with a couple of exceptions that you could show to somebody from the 1960s and they'd enjoy it, or the 1950s, 1940s even, allowing for the anachronisms and the nudity. It's an incredibly accessible, fun adventure film, and I think that there are a lot of American adventure films that could learn a lot from this one and learn a lot from Luc Besson if they were just going to let themselves learn.
Yeah, well, even this one, from what I've read, the bath scene was actually cut for the American release, which doesn't surprise me entirely, but that's the sort of thing that is they're still fighting against, so...
Yeah, there's. I think the bath scene's important too because she does say that she reads all of her mail in the bath, and an important bit of information is given to her in a letter. And I think that she's got this great big old water heater next to the bathtub. It's a big old French bath as well, and it's very in character for her to sit in there smoking a cigarillo in the bath and reading her mail. It's very in character.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I think it actually works, well, apart from being the fact that I'm a heterosexual male, it works because the character is that sort of person who would sit there smoking in the bathtub reading the mail.
Yeah.
They balance off that kind of harshness of the character and how determined she is and how no bullshit with the fact that she's got a personal tragedy.
Yes.
Really well, and it doesn't make the film heavier because of the innate absurdity of what happened to her sister. It doesn't drag the film down. It kind of drives it forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is an interesting aspect to it as well. The tennis match is kind of cool between her and her sister where the accident occurs. And it does show that she is somebody who cares about her family. And cares, you know, if she cares about somebody, she cares about them and will go to any lengths to help them. And I think that works really well.
Mm. Yeah. No, it's
but
good.
And anything else you want to say about it? I mean, all the steampunky stuff in there would have been a thrill to you.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those ones. There's, I suppose, it's not what I would consider steampunk directly, but there's a lot of, you know, I mean, it's that turn of the century fantasy. I love that the, you know, as she's talking to the mummy of Putmosis.
Yeah.
And he sort of turns around and goes, oh, you know, no, me, a doctor, puh, you know, I'm a nuclear physicist. And then, you know, his sort of, his understanding of nuclear physics is so far in advance of you know, like quantum physics that we've got and all that sort of stuff that he can, you know, he effectively becomes a magician because of his understanding of, you know, the realms of nuclear physics. And that sort of stuff I quite love. And then, you know, when they sort of, they gather all the mummies together and they're all going out on tour and going, oh, look at that. Obviously, you know, very artistic people here, but, you know, they're still sort of such a barbaric culture, which, you know, sort of it's, I suppose the direct inversion of the way that the 19th century archaeologists were referring to Egypt at the time. So, oh, very artistic, but, you know, obviously a barbaric culture.
And so, I like the way Patmosis, the mummy, is a very nice person.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's, you know, a lovely character.
Well, that was one thing that, you know, I did sit there going, you know, they've got 5,000-year-old Egyptian mummies who understand perfect French.
Yeah, but you've got to forgive that kind of thing in this kind of movie.
Yeah, I know. So, but, you know, it's sort of, you know, when he wakes up in her apartment and he sort of apologizes for smashing the glass and asks if he can make himself a cup of tea and all this sort of stuff. And, yeah,
He's a lovely character.
Yeah.
And even the pharaoh, when he's resurrected, is quite reasonable too, within being a pharaoh and being up himself.
Yes.
He still does help out and still understands what's necessary. And it'd be interesting to see what happens to the pharaoh and all of his entourage when they finally do get back to Egypt.
Yes, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, they've got some lovely CGI in this as well. There's some beautiful special effects work, particularly with Patmosis and the pharaohs and them.
Yeah.
They really do come across as real characters.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's very nicely done.
But there's not too much else to say about this one, apart from the fact that if you haven't seen it, see it. And see it with a couple of people if you can.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those movies that is good to share.
Mm.
And I want to see more of this kind of stuff from Luc Besson in future. I mean, he's doing Lucy, the one where Scarlett Johansson ingests a lot of experimental drugs as a drug courier and gets superpowers. Yeah. I want to see that.
Seen the trailer for that, and that sort of looks, you know, I think, you know, Mitch turned around and said, you know, if we don't get a Black Widow movie after this, there is something seriously wrong.
Yeah, because we do need a Black Widow movie. But I think what they're going to do is, if they do it, they'll do it a little bit later, so because it's going to be similar in genre to the second Captain America movie.
Yeah.
And they want to kind of vary the genres a lot with the Marvel films, but I want to see one as well.
Yeah.
A Black Widow one would be interesting.
So,
but, yeah, I think there are a number of ones I want to see. But yeah.
I mean, yeah, Luc Besson is certainly, you know, he's got the range, you know, from doing sort of the, you know, this – to, I suppose, the ridiculousness of The Fifth Element, to you know, doing things like Nikita. I think he was doing
District 13.
Yeah.
So a puck tour action film.
Oh, what was the Leon? That was one of your favorite movies.
And The Transporter. No, well, it's not one of my favorite movies, but I did watch it on Blu-ray.
Okay.
But
and The Transporter. But, yeah, I mean, he certainly...
He did Taken with Liam Neeson. Yeah. Yeah. So, he's definitely got his finger in a lot of pies there.
Yeah, so he's certainly shown that he's got a range of things that he can do as a director. But, yeah, it'd be nice to see more of this sort of stuff. So whether he can adapt, because I suppose, you know, action movie is action movie, and, you know, I suppose that's the Michael Bay theory of an explosion doesn't need to be translated. Whether he could do something like this as an English language comedy would be interesting. Although, you know, I mean, there's certainly a lot of that in stuff like The Fifth Element. I mean, you know, Gary Oldman's character in that is that whole sort of camp villain thing.
Yeah, and the fact they got Jean-Paul Gaultier to do all the costumes.
Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah, I talked about that in a previous podcast, The Fifth Element, because it is just such fun.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'll say anything that Besson does, because if nothing else, it's going to be a good, fun action film.
Yep.
And at the best, it'll delight you. So there's a range there that's slightly higher than the range for a number of other people.
Yep.
He's like the anti-Michael Bay in the sense that his stuff's entertaining.
Yes.
Yeah, and his characters matter. So, yeah, that's about it for The Extraordinary Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec. I want to see some more films with Louise Burgoyne, maybe see what she's like as a contemporary actor and see her stuff, because she is a lot of fun in this film, and basically she's in 90% of the scenes in the movie.
Yep.
And carries it across very well.
Yes.
So that's about it, and that's about it for you and me, pal.
All right. Well, thank you for having
me. Okay, anything you want to plug?
Nothing that springs to mind. I think based off the enjoyment of French films, I will recommend another French film that I did find very enjoyable, and that's Brotherhood of the Wolf.
With Jean Reno?
Yes.
I was seeing that. Or was it Vincent Cassel?
I'm thinking
Is this the period piece movie?
The period one, yep.
Okay, because there's another one, Something of the Wolf, with Jean Reno, which is a contemporary movie. But, yeah, Brotherhood of the Wolf is great fun with the Beast.
Yeah, Le Pacte de Loup. With Samuel Le Bon. Yeah, Vincent Cassel. Billy Dank.
I should actually...
Monica Bellucci.
I remember Monica Bellucci from the film. Let me find that other...
Jeremy Renner. I don't remember...
Jeremy Renner was in it.
I don't remember him being in it. Hang on.
Okay.
Oh, no. Different Jeremy Renner.
Yeah, because the name's so common, I suppose.
Yeah, wow.
Now, I'll find the name of that. Before we go, I'll find the name of that other Jean Reno one from a while back, which was really, really interesting. L'Empire de Loups, 2005, Empire of the Wolves.
All right, yep.
That one's got some really nice stuff in it. If you get a chance to see that, it's nothing to do with Luc Besson. But as a Jean Reno action film, it's terrific. And it's got a couple of twists in the plot, which are remarkable. And I haven't seen them done anywhere else. And it's the sort of thing that if a lot of people saw this particular twist in the plot, you'd see it all over episodic television in America.
Mm.
I won't spoil it apart from that.
Uh-huh. Yep.
But, but that'd be my recommendation. A lot of people didn't like it, but I enjoyed it. And anyway, Paul, thank you very much for coming on again. We'll do another one. We won't do the Great Race, but we'll do something else. we will have to catch up and have a bowl of fur at some stage.
Sounds good.
Okay, well, I'll catch up with you soon, mate. Okay, it's me back again. I haven't got any feedback this time around, but I do have some credits to read out. Part of the thing with the Patreon campaign is that donors get movie-style credits at the end of the podcast. So I would like to thank Alyssa, our location scout, Tansy, our Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher M, the gaffer, Chris M, the camera operator, Julia, our casting director, Jan, the dialect coach, Gary, our property master, and Morris, our musical director. So thanks to all of those lovely people for donating to help keep the podcast going. And I will be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Driving podcast, and in another week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. So in the meantime, look after yourselves, take care, stay warm if you're down here, stay cool if you're up there, and keep watching the skies. I'm going to leave you now with a song about Adele Blanc-Sec, which is right at the end of the movie. It's quite a sweet little thing. And if you don't speak French, you probably don't understand the lyrics of this, but I like it. And I'm now going to play it for you.
Elle est au-dessus des lois, terre à terre. Elle trouve un peu trop étroit l'univers. Aurait du sang-froid en enfer.
Il me sort son cinéma.
J'exagère.
Il est dans tous ses états à bout de nerfs.
Elle
papa, je désespère. Je lis sur son doux visage un rêve. Son cœur se rit des naufrages et se relève. Un jour enfin son voyage s'achève. Et moi, je porterai bien ses bagages. Elle côtoie de drôles d'oiseaux sanguinaires. C'est les anges gardiens, les cerbères. Vraiment quel foutu
caractère. De New York à Calcutta, rien à faire.
Je serai toujours planté là
dans sa sphère.
Au moindre faux pas, j'obtempère. Sur son doux visage, un rêve. Son cœur se rit des naufrages et se relève. Un jour enfin son voyage s'achève. Et moi, je porterai bien ses bagages. Des chapeaux de marquise,
mes bibelots, mes valises,
même une baignoire et un arrosoir,
tous mes grimoires, mon samovar.
Mademoiselle Adèle?
Oui?
Je vous ai pris une passoire.
Pourquoi?
Non, c'est à tout hasard, parce que je ne sais jamais.
Oh, quel bazar.
Enfin, elle est là.
Très bien, voilà, merci.
Elle est là.
Au revoir.
Elle n'a pas besoin de moi. Comment faire pour qu'elle pense un peu à moi? C'est pas ce que tu crois, au contraire. Je lis sur son doux visage un rêve. Son cœur se rit des naufrages et se relève. Un jour enfin son voyage s'achève. J'attends sur le rivage.
Bien fait. Allez, au revoir.